Good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore. We're here with another of our virtual events, and really excited today to see two good friends. And we're here to talk about Ben Winter's spectacular new book, The Quiet Boy.
Yeah, okay.
It's funny. Thanks for everybody for tuning in. We had a little kerfuffle yesterday, but it was funny. Let's see.
Here, don't worry.
Actually, this is kind of apropos. It's funny, Ben. Dwayne and I were talking about, well, since this book deals a lot with the theme of absence, you know, maybe we could just talk about it, and we could have an avatar of Ben, like walking around in a circle behind while we're doing the program.
That would be very good. Just like a wind-up toy of me. Enacting the horror at the center of The Quiet Boy. That would be great. That'd be good.
Never aging, never eating, never anything. Yep. You know,
doesn't pee or poop. Just like
But for those of you watching, let's see. Ben will kindly sign a batch of books which just got to him recently, and I'll go ahead and put a link in the comments field. So if you'd like to order a signed copy of The Quiet Boy, this is my advanced, well-read, coffee mug stained advanced reading copy. But, you know, Ben's been a big favorite of mine for a long, long time. One of the most inventive original writers at work today. Last Policeman trilogy, Underground Airlines, all kinds of great stuff over the years, young adult fiction. I'm also really happy to see my friend Dwayne Straczynski here again. And I always butcher your last name. I hope that was vaguely close.
You got it perfectly. That was great. Really? Yeah. You nailed it.
Well, it's always good to see you, man. And I really appreciate you joining us today to do the heavy lifting on talking to Ben, which I'll hand over to you mostly, but I do have some comments and questions that I'm going to toss into the pot here. But for those of you watching, which is everybody, of course, we did it. This is sort of an encore presentation. Yes. We had a really fun event, 6 weeks or so ago, a month ago, for this wonderful anthology, Speculative Los Angeles, that Denise Hamilton has put together. And I gave Denise a very fond ribbing on Facebook, because, man, she took that show on the road in the Los Angeles area. And you know, each day or each week, there's somebody else signing. And I said, folks, that's how you sell some damn books.
True. She showed up at my house with a box full of books in the trunk one afternoon and just had me sign for 45 minutes, and she drove away again. It was like a paramilitary operation. She, you know, I'm here, you want to sign these? Let's take a picture. And then she was gone.
Amazing.
Right. Absolutely. Well, Dwayne, I'll go ahead and hand it over to you for the moment, and then I'll pop up from time to time.
I'm super happy to be here talking to both of you and Ben. You know, Ben and I don't know, you know, we actually met, I want to say 10 years ago at the Edgars briefly, because, you know, and we should have met years ago because we both lived in Philadelphia at the same time.
Yep.
For like the same year. Publisher.
Yep.
But we really should have collided, but we actually met here in LA, which is just wrong, right? How'd that happen?
And the thing is that I've known of Dwayne, and we've had mutual friends for like Dwayne said, like a decade. And then we had lunch finally here in LA. It was like late February. And I was like, I really like this guy. I think we're going to be good friends. And then there was this pandemic.
Exactly.
And I haven't seen him since. It's like, it's a friendship just evaporated. So
a bromance then ruined by a pandemic. That's like, it was hard.
Like a rom-com horror movie.
Yeah. But no, I actually, and I should hate Ben, because, you know, the highest compliment you pay to the writer is like, wow, I wish I thought of that idea. God, I hate that guy. He thought of it first. And in pretty much every book of Ben's, I feel that way. It's like, God damn it. Why this guy? But I love Ben, and I love Ben's work. And this book, God, you know, wow. It blew me away, because I'm not, honestly, legal thrillers are not my go-to. I mean, they're fine. I admire them. But I can't say it's my first, you know, my first reach. And Ben has this wonderful gift of like combining, you know, several genres into, you know, kind of a weird souffle that all not only makes sense, it's beautiful and shows you the capabilities of all the genres. So I should hate Ben. I adore Ben. This book is wonderful. It really is. I'm so happy, because, you know, you're always nervous, like, you know, a friend or a bromance says, oh, read my book. Let's do an event. Like, okay. It's so wonderful when it's like you love the book. So this will be a joy.
And I have two things to say. One is that I'm going to make, when the paperback comes out, put a weird souffle and then herb on the back from Dwayne Sprzedzinski. And then also I have to return the compliment because I read, when we scheduled this event, I finally read your book Revolver and I was astonished by how good it was. I love that. And I especially was angry at you because I labored so hard on the time jumping structure of this book, which we can get into.
I have a question about that.
Because Patrick, you've read it also. There are two timelines in this book, a sort of present and a past. But in The Revolver, there are three timelines. And I was like, mother, you know, this guy, you know, anyway, it's a great, great book. And I think that the
construction
is really cool. And yeah, there are very, very few books. I hope that this one comes close, but that really do that well. And I think yours is, Revolver is definitely one of them.
Well, I got to say, I mean, I have a question later about that. But honestly, your timeline jumping was seamless. I didn't feel, I mean, I knew it was happening, but it was how the book is meant to be. And I've read other books where it's like, it jumps in times. It's like, oh, this feels forced. Like, oh, we better do this information here now. And it's, but let's go back to actually, I'm dying to know, you know, I know that novels never come from like one idea. It's usually a few ideas that collide. And I was hoping you'd walk us through like, what were the inspirations and ideas that collided in your mind and created this?
Thank you. Well, first, let me just quickly, for those who haven't read it, I know there are probably still a lot of people who haven't read it yet because it just came out.
It's new, actually, yeah.
But like, basically, hold on one second. I'm trying to get my dog to relax. It's funny because this book is called The Quiet Boy, and the whole time I've been doing press for it, it's like he's like the loudest boy. He's not being loud right now, but he's being a pain in the chest. Hold on, brother.
The noisy boy.
The noisy boy. If I sit here and give him a pet. So basically the book is about, it's about a family and a lawyer, right? So in the present day timeline, there's this kind of decrepit personal injury lawyer who ends up representing a man who's been accused of murder. And in the past, like 10 years ago, it's the same lawyer. He's a much more joyful, happy character. He's representing the same family when their son goes in for what should be a relatively routine surgery and ends up afflicted by some completely bizarre ailment. And so it takes a while for us to understand the relationship between these two timelines and what the deal is with the boy. That's what's at the center of it. What's going on with this boy? And it's either a neurological disorder, heretofore unseen, or I don't even know how to describe it, a sort of supernatural infestation kind of thing going on. And I was thinking about this question of like where this book came from, because it was sort of a long gestation. You know how it is, like some books, you have an idea and you just roar into it. This one I sort of slowly was thinking about for a long time. And in fact, Golden State, my previous novel, came in between. Like I started this book after Underground Airlines.
Oh,
and I kind of put it aside and I wrote Golden State and I came back to this and the idea had evolved and changed. But the original impulse, I think, came from a book that I read by Andrew Solomon called Far From the Tree, which if you haven't read, I think it won the National Book Award. It was a nonfiction book and it's this massive book where every chapter is about a family that has a child that is somehow either grievously ill or somehow completely different from the family. So there's a chapter about dwarfs and kids who were born with dwarfism and how the parents deal with that. There's a chapter about deaf children. There's a chapter about gay and transgender and just families trying to figure out how to deal with a kid that's so different from their expectation.
Yeah.
And I found the book to be, he's such a great writer and it's just a very moving book. And it maybe really got me thinking about family and about how families deal with children who throw them for a loop in some way. And I sort of, that took me down a kind of rabbit hole of thinking about my own family, and somewhere in there is where this idea came from, basically. Somewhere in there.
Wow. I mean, because, you know, it makes a lot of sense. Because the only thing that spoke to me was, the beautiful thing is, it is like, in some ways, a legal thriller married to a really great X-Files episode. And don't take that the wrong way. It's like, it's, you know, it's so well done, but what makes this-
No wrong way to take that, Dwayne. There's no wrong way to take that. Thank you.
What makes it beautiful is that, because it is like a family. It's a weird family of both origin and creation, because there's a lot of different kind of family units here going on. And I was just really impressed by that. And it's what actually, honestly, what makes it so alive and wonderful. So that to me, you know, I guess, you know, we all know that, you know, characters are key with these things. But there's one character I truly love is, you know, Reuben the Rabbi. You know, he's just like, you know, I love them all. And they all have it. But Reuben, okay, where did he come from? Because
Reuben.
I love that guy.
Thank
love
you, Reuben. So Dwayne is talking about Reuben Schenck, who is
the son of the lawyer.
He's the kind of the co-protagonist. I guess the way the novel is structured is that in the past timeline, in the medical malpractice timeline, The hero is Jay Shank, who is Ruben's dad, who's this hustling, I call him a cheerfully amoral, a personal injury lawyer. You might call him just a classic American scumbag.
Saul Goodman.
What?
Saul Goodman.
Yeah, he's a Saul Goodman-esque. Jonathan Ames was nice enough to compare him to like a Willie Loman. He's just like, he's a hard worker.
Yeah.
You know, like he, but then Ruben is his son. And in the past timeline, Ruben is like 12, 14, I think.
He's yeah. 14.
And then in the present day, he's a young man in his early 20s whose life is just, has not gotten started. Like when we meet him, he is working at a salad restaurant. Like it's called Killer Greens, but it's like a Sweet Greens, you know, where you go up and you order your base and your protein and your, and he's, so he's just, he chops vegetables all day. That's what he does. And he has no real ambition or understanding of himself. And he's a bit of a lost soul. And basically he's, it emerges as he's been more or less estranged from his dad for years. And the novel, one of the sort of axes of the story is about their re-engagement and his coming to terms with what happened to him vis-a-vis his dad in his childhood. And the reason, so the character's nickname is the Rabbi. And in fact, the first line of the novel is, I'll just read you the first sentence, which you know how it is with first sentences, right? The phone was ringing at the Killer Greens, but what business was that of the rabbis? And like, I really want there to be just a little bit of that dissonance when you're reading the book of like, wait, is this a rabbi that's working at a salad restaurant? Like, I don't understand.
Right, right.
And what it emerges is that he's also, although he is Jewish, he's Asian, he's adopted. And so when his coworker, who she's the kind of person who teases everybody, when she finds out that he's Jewish, she thinks it's the funniest goddamn thing. And so she starts calling him the rabbi. And so that's his nickname at work. But then over the course of the novel, hopefully it becomes his sort of private detective nickname for himself. When he becomes a PI sort of accidentally, he starts to call himself the rabbi in an almost unconscious, like, okay, I'm going to accept the fact that I'm kind of cool. And this is my kind of cool, interesting, like the rabbi. Like, so when there are moments when he's on the hunt or he's like, he finds a weapon or he's like, the rabbi, it's like, it becomes a kind of totemic thing.
Yeah, totally.
So I guess his growth, hopefully the arc of that character is from someone who has no real, whose identity is a bit of a mess, because from the way he was raised and his dad kind of did a number on him, as all of our dads, my dad is literally here right now. My parents are visiting for the first
time. Oh, really?
Oh, our dads, they can't help it. You know, we all have a complicated relationship with our dad. If we're lucky enough to have one, and I am, but Ruben, his dad is a force of nature and he's this ball of energy and he's always working and he's always talking and he's always loving everything. And Ruben is like, he just wants his dad to slow down for a minute and just love him specifically. You know what I mean? And it's like, So the novel is about his journey toward a sense of himself and a sense of comfort with his past and with his father.
I do love the contrast of the past, the younger Ruben with the adult, you know, the young adult Ruben, which is pretty striking because it kind of does parallel how we all grow up and kind of think, oh, you know, your parents are amazing. They're gods when you're 12 or 14. When you're older, it's like, oh, these guys suck. They're awful.
My God.
You know, it's this great, wonderful, real thing. And it's also, I thought it was a very sly way to give an origin story for a fantastic private eye. I mean, I had to ask you, will this guy go on? Will you return to Ruben? I don't know. I'm
mad at sequels, man.
I know.
It's funny too, but I love that question. I love the idea of writing more Ruben. I do love Ruben. And like, I've also, this novel was a lot of pushing for me, pushing into new kinds of writing, I guess. And like writing the scenes with him as a 14-year-old and Evie, who we meet as a 12-year-old, and they flirt with each other and they have like a little crush on each other. And then we meet them as adults. And like, they think there's a genuine kind of like love story. And like, I've never done anything like that before. My fiction is very,
you've done that before. I mean, you've done relationships and loving relationships. You've done that.
But it's a little different. I guess that loving relationship is very noir. Like this relationship is like, it's a little bit of a meet cute and then a re-encounter and like the stakes have changed. And
yeah,
I don't know. I found that to be really pleasing and kind of exciting to write that kind of stuff. And it was part of his journey back toward a sense of himself is that, oh, he's like, oh, this girl's really hot. And I think she's into me. I'm like, what the heck? So like, it was really pleasing.
Yeah.
Speaking of doubles, too.
A lot of what?
I was just going to say, Dwayne, didn't you find that there were a lot of kind of doubles throughout the book? You know, two fathers and sons.
Totally.
Really enjoyed that aspect of it.
Oh, thank you, Patrick. Yeah.
Absolutely.
It was interesting. It was like, it's that thing of once you discover a theme or an idea, you didn't even necessarily, you guys are both writers. Like when you go into a store, it's like, you don't necessarily know what you're going to find there. Like you have some sense of it. And with this, it was about like, okay, the kid's going to, all I knew going in basically was like, there's going to be a kid who's screwed up. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be a big question the whole time as to what exactly the nature of it is. And then there's going to be the parallel timelines. That was what I wanted structurally and story-wise. But then the stuff about fathers and sons and about mothers and sons too, because the mom of that poor kid is, she's central too, but all of that develops. And then once you feel it developing, you kind of grab onto it. You know, what else do I want to do with this? How else is this? Where else can I tell this same story in a different way? You know what I mean?
Yeah. To Patrick's point, I mean, it's a story of two families, right? Both are grieving in very different ways. They both lost something essential to their unit. And it's just how they all deal with each other is pretty fascinating. I mean, I believe as I get older, I get more, softer. And, I just think that stuff I love. It's my catnip. I think God, he nailed it, And it's really, of course I was there strapped in for the cool otherworldly Ben Winter stuff. And that's what I come for, And you deliver beautifully, but it's also enmeshed with, this really kind of big idea. I won't even go near that because I don't want to ruin it for anybody. But I do want to roll it back and ask about, the two levels, the medical research. My question is, was the medical research difficult or was it difficult and depressing? Which one?
It was difficult. It was depressing for sure. I know there's a couple books that I read. I read a book. I wish I could remember the name right now, but I'll find it and I'll maybe we could put it in the chat or something. But it was a memoir of a young woman whose brother had been in a terrible motorcycle accident and ended up in a persistent vegetative state. And her memoir of growing up in the shadow of that event and her parents having to cope with it and it becoming so much what her life was about. And loving her brother, I mean, it makes me so sad to think about it, but like just loving her brother and spending time at his bedside. And there's a scene in the book, a couple scenes where Evie is like, everyone's like, what the fuck's going on with this kid? And what are we going to do? And she just walks behind him in circle. Like he walks endlessly. That's he's frozen in time. He just walks and she'll just walk behind him. And there's a part where she's like, what if he just wakes up? What if he just suddenly turns to me and winks? And it's like, the whole thing's a joke. Just don't tell anybody. Like those sorts of, so I did a lot of reading about that experience and medical stuff. I am lucky enough to have a first cousin who is a professor of neuroscience. And she,
great.
She teaches, her name is Stephanie Simon Dack, and she teaches at Ball State in Muncie, Indiana. And she's a fucking genius. And like, she understands this stuff. And not only does she understand it, she loves it. And is, for my money, when I'm writing a book, my favorite thing is calling people. I love calling people.
Yeah.
Tell me everything you know about whatever. And it started with Last Policeman, where I found an asteroid guy really early on. And the thing is that people love to share. If you spend a lifetime learning about something, they love to talk. And sometimes people are just waiting for someone to call. I mean, like, I'm a novelist. Tell me everything you know about life insurance. So, you know what I mean? Once there was a guy, when we lived in Indy, we were redoing our driveway, and I was writing World of Trouble, and there was a guy who came to do the driveway. And I was like, hey, if I wanted to dig a bunker in my garage and cover it over with a cement roof, how would I do that? He was like, well, I'm glad you asked. You know what I mean? Like, so
I think funny.
Call the police, but like, so with this one, I talked to Stephanie forever about different neurodegenerative diseases and the different ways that the brain can, the different sort of sectors of the brain and what can happen if different things happen to them. I tried to sort of come as close as I could to an illness that was real so that I could describe it with terminology that was real, even though mine is invented. And it's sort of like with The Last Policeman, where I went to the asteroid guy and I was like, basically, I want you to describe for me what the science would be if an asteroid did come. How would that work? And he's like, well, there isn't really any such thing, but I can get you close. You know, he's like, I can get you your asteroid. Yeah. And with this, Stephanie sort of got me close. And it has to do ultimately with mad cow disease and the different, it's called a prion disease, where something can, kind of thing, a microbe. See, the science just flies out of my head. I finished the book and I just forget everything. But like, it in one's brain and then lie dormant for years, and then something can activate it. You know, the trauma of a surgery. So anyway, so Stephanie was amazing. The medical stuff. There's a lot of law stuff. I talked to a ton of lawyers.
That too. The law stuff was equally impressive. Like, me kind of felt like, it reminded me of of Michael Crichton stuff, where it's like, you know, you're learning a lot, but it's also like, it feels effortless. It feels like, oh yeah, it's that revelation of like, this is cool shit I should know. Sorry if I cursed. Cool stuff I should know. But it's like, you know, but it's living in such an entertaining way. I feel like, oh, I'm being taught something cool, you know, whereas in science class, I'd fall asleep.
And you know what the secret is? And you know this already, it's all character, right? It's like, you can't just, as the omniscient narrator, be like, explain the,
right,
the science. You it has to be Shank being like, no, fucking tell me again. I don't understand, tell me again. So that you're learning it along with someone, or you're telling it along with someone. So the audience, the reader is invested in the character's journey. And along the way, you're getting that information in there so that they don't even realize they're learning it.
Nothing worse than like a writer showing his or her homework. You don't do that. I mean, it's you did a lot of homework, I can tell, but it's also never felt like, oh, here's Ben's info dump. It never, ever felt like, it was like, wow, okay.
Thank you.
I feel so like, you know.
The law stuff I love. I mean, and I am like, I'm very much of lawyers. Like my dad is a lawyer. My brother is a lawyer. My wife is a lawyer. So like I've always been fascinated. And like, seriously, my parents they told me to go to law school until like my fifth novel was published. You know what I mean? There's definitely
need a backup plan, kid.
Yeah. What are you up to here? When is this going to peter out?
I'm like, exactly.
This is the New York Times bestseller. Yeah, it's all right.
It's like right for TV and stuff. But come on, back to law school. Let's go.
Yeah.
It's funny. Yesterday we were talking just for a few minutes, Dwayne and I. And I was like, yeah, you know, maybe we should play like some Syd Barrett music. But see, I'm really interested. I've always been fascinated with Acid Casualties. You know, like the Syd Barretts and the Peter Greens and people like that, who their body remains, you know, and they, like in Syd Barrett's case, you know, he left the building and went to go home and live with his mom for 30 years.
What's so interesting about that, Patrick, it's like, and that goes to what's one of the questions I got really interested in, and like, including like in terms of the research and stuff, like what does it mean to be a human being at this sort of essential level? It's like you're a physical body. You are inhabited by this physical thing that we call a brain that is a collection of cells. And then beyond that, we believe, or we like to believe, there is something that is called a person that is other than and aside from that, but inhabits you. But it's like, that's an illusion, or in my belief, it's a bit of a trick. And it's sort of like when that brain shuts down, like, what is that? What remains? Can we stop all that thing that is there the same that is a person? But at the same time, it's like, well, then what's the line? If someone starts to have, you know, Alzheimer's or another disease of memory, and they lose all of what they were in the sense of their memories, they're recognizing the people they've loved, like, it is still the same person, right? We have to, we're not just, but it's not. And like that.
Yeah.
It's an existential question that sort of, I hope, sort of floats over this book for me. Wesley's gone, but he's there.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well,
a lot of it's about how it affects the other people, not necessarily the afflicted individual. It's how the people that love him or her
respond. Totally. In that sense, it's like Waiting for Godot, where like, he's the title character, but he's the character we spend the least time actually with, in a sense.
Yeah, exactly.
About the people in his orbit. Yeah.
Now that you mention it, this is a very Beckett novel.
Thank you. So is Last Policeman, to be honest with you. Like, I think I never would have, when I started my career as a crime writer, been like, I really want to write philosophical novels. Like, somehow it keeps happening. I'm very interested in like what's the deal? You know, what is
I love on? Those the trilogy so much, you know, Malone Dies and The Unnameable.
Crazy.
Just such amazing books.
I totally agree. And like that sense of just it's the two-part thing of like, well, life is meaningless, period. But it's not a period. It's life is meaningless, semicolon, therefore find joy. Like, therefore, that's how I come out of it, is like,
yeah.
Or just live, fucking live. Because there's an asteroid coming, you know, where like you're gonna fall down one day. And like, what do you do with that information? You don't despair. You can't despair. Like, just go do and be happy and make other people happy. Like, I don't know. Yeah.
That brings back to a question I had, but you know, about, you know, a lot of your books, they are a blend of different genres. You cross like a crime writer now, which is like, you are, but you're also a lot of other writers too. You're wearing different hats, which is what I love about your work. It's truly, you know, to me, makes it fresh. And, you know, it's the big ideas I'm always craving for. And my big problem with, you know, some crime novels, like, it's just, it's great, technically brilliant, but it's same old, you're reaching for big questions here. You know, and I wonder you know, was that a plan to, you know, smash genres? Is this, that's where your brain goes? And is it hard for you? Is it hard to like convince our mutual editor or previous editors, hey, I have this crazy idea?
To the contrary, at a certain point, it becomes like a little baked in where it's sort of like, I knew I wanted to write, like, I don't think I could get away at this point with just being like, well, it's a legal thriller. People would be like, well, what planet does it take place on? Or like, you know what I mean? Like, what's the weird thing? I guess I didn't plan on that. I'm being a young ending writer, you know, and on it, and truthfully, like, there's a sense in which I've had this conversation with my editor. I'm like, maybe I just need to come up with a serious character who is some sort of, you know, agent or and goes around just like, but I don't think that's just, and I don't, not to knock books like that. I do like,
yeah, no, I hear you.
People who are great at it are so good at it. Like, you cannot wait to read another one.
Yes.
The people who, in my opinion, are less great at it, it feels like a crossword puzzle, right? It feels like you're just like, oh, okay, they're setting up X, they're setting up Y. We're going to see how those letters fit together. It's going to be satisfying,
but then
it's going to go in the recycling. I think there's always a part of me that is like, I should do something more traditional. I think in terms of market share or whatever, you know, you think about these things at a certain point, it's like, well, what is my role in the marketplace? But I think, yeah, you know, it's the old, like, I am what I am, you know, I enjoy
all that.
I like thinking about, there's a real challenge and a real pleasure in thinking about things from just from another direction, or asking yourself, what is there going to be about this book that will be entirely unfamiliar, that will be something that we haven't seen before? And it really, it started with The Last Policeman. I really did. I was working for Quirk Books, as you were at the time. And we had a visual editor there too, it was Jason Rakulik. And I had done two of those mashup novels, right? I did Sensibility and Sea Monsters, and I did Android Karenina. I loved writing those books. I didn't want to wake up in 30 years and be like, well, this is what I did. You know what I mean? This was my contribution. So, but I knew I wanted to write a detective novel, and I was like, or a crime novel. And I was like, what can I do that will make it different? Like, what will be, and that has continued to sort of serve me well a little bit, you know?
Is it more about you? Like, almost like, are you talking yourself into like being emotionally invested enough in something to like guide you through the months it takes to write a book? Or,
I guess so. You know that feeling where it's like, oh yes, I want to spend time here. Like, I want to like live in this universe. And I know that, I love that period, which I'm in now with the next one, where it's like, you're just kind of, you're living in this world. I'm doing a lot of reading and I'm like, think of who's the people I'm going to call for this. And you're doing this stuff where you know, like, you know, you're tricking yourself. This structure isn't really going to be the ultimate structure, but it's fun to play around and like, you're building this universe that you're going to live in. And like, so I think it is a question of like, what am I going to find that joy in for this time, you know?
Speaking of structure, that comes the ultimate timeline question. I'm very curious because I mentioned I did a book with a few timelines. I was very impressed by how you handled it. How was it? Like, how much of a headache or non-headache was it for you?
It was a headache. I found it to be really stressful because I am not a super organized person in my mind or like anywhere, my car, my house. Like, every day I'm like, where are my glasses? I can't find my glasses. Like, so stuff like that. So like, I get really confused about dates and times. So I had to keep writing and rewriting and rechecking and like, I'm praying that there's no like confuse, like I didn't mess anything up in this book. And I know it's not most readers don't go back and be like, wait a second, that's the wrong date. Like, but you want it to be all correct. So I found that really stressful. And also I had to change the whole thing because I was finishing this novel in the spring of last year when we had lunch. And so the novel had been set in 2020 because I thought it was going to come out in late 2020. And so I was like, oh, wait, none of this could happen, you know, because you know, there's a whole section that takes place in an outdoor music festival.
Of course,
I had to redo it. I had to backdate the whole. I decided the best thing to do was to backdate it by a year, so that the present day story takes place in 2019.
Yeah,
and so that was a whole new sort of last round of date futzing.
Oh, see, I assumed all along it was planned to be like, you know, just by a happy accident, it was set in those years, like pre-pandemic. That okay, you lucked out. Here we go.
Yeah. And what's funny, there's one interesting detail about California law that I had to change that I caught in the very last, having to do with the death penalty law that I had that changed in the intervening year, that I realized in the very last minute that I had, by moving it back a year, I had to change. So that was the one thing. I was like, ah, I got it. I'm hoping everything else is right.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive. You know, speaking of California, another question I had was, you know, you are a transplant to LA, as I am. How has that impacted your creative life? Like, do you think now in terms of LA ideas, California ideas, or has not, I don't know, has that had an impact on you?
Yeah, it totally has. I think it probably has in two ways. One is just like, I definitely, as you wrote, like Revolver is such a beautiful Philadelphia now. Like, it's so like, it's resonant with Philadelphia, right? And so I can feel that coming off of you in waves. Like, that's just your home mind. Not to say that all of your work is set there, but it's like—
Totally, totally, yeah.
I love that sense of place that you get from just being somewhere. And yeah. Like, so the Policeman novels, like I was living in Boston, but my brother lived in Concord, New Hampshire. And like, I just spent so much time walking around that like, I, you know, so
that's where it felt real to you, yeah.
Just felt, I was like, let's just make this novel. Yeah. So, and similarly with Underground Airlines, we had moved to Indianapolis. We moved a lot. So, but with this book, as I was writing it, I was like, this is just, it feels like I wanted to be here. Shank felt like an LA kind of guy to me.
Totally.
Like his law firm just had to be at one of the, I love the strip malls, the little shopping centers in LA.
Totally. There. Oh yeah. Yeah.
Just like, well, there are two levels and there's always a donut shop and there's always a nail salon and there's a yoga place. There's a taco place. There's like, I love them all so much. Like
there would be a gun shop at the Phoenix version of that.
Yeah. Too. Totally. And maybe boots. I don't know what else. So I just knew that that's where he had to be. And so really I set the novel, like it all takes place within like a mile of where I'm sitting right now. Like he lives in my neighborhood. Shank lives in my neighborhood. I could, next time we have lunch, I will point to you, the shopping center. He works, you know, like
moving
to school, I could tell you where it is. So like, I love that. I love it. Just, it's like, it almost, ultimately the reader probably won't live in West LA. Hopefully there'll be readers who aren't just my friends here. You know what I mean? But like,
of course, yeah.
that sense of the real, I think that readers can feel it. That sense of like, this is a real place.
Absolutely.
That, you know, and I really like that. It makes it more fun. And I think it just, so that's one answer. And the other answer is, I think since I've been here in LA, I've been working not nonstop, but here and there I've been done TV stuff. And that just the way of thinking, I know people make fun of TV writing and it can be terrible, but I've worked with a lot of smart people and a lot of people who don't write books, but who write long, complicated stories with multiple characters and multiple points of view.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And TV has become so novelistic that I think it's actually expanded my sense of what's possible a little bit and my own way of thinking about a book. Like I definitely, for this book, I think this is the first time I've ever done this. I put it all on index cards and I laid it out on the floor, which is just a TV writer thing to do. And I don't think the novel plays like a TV program, but I do think it helped me to kind of expand the universe of it in a certain way.
I see it as a prestige miniseries. Honestly, it just screams that kind of like, you know how we talk about that now? It's like that kind of idea of like,
it's a prestige limited
story. It's not a series, it's a prestige, you know, it's, and I mean, I'm not being facetious, being serious. Just feels like,
you know, your friends who work at HBO Max or any number of places now. It could be on Peacock. You know, there's so many.
I'll call my executive friends. Hey, to me, novels are always top of the food chain. However, I hear you about working my limited ways in both comics and TV has definitely changed my novel outlook for that same reason. Like it sort of opens your mind to different possibilities, different dramatic possibilities. So this reads like best of all worlds me. So
there's also a scene in the book that is set on a soundstage where they're shooting a television show,
right?
Which anyone who read my previous novel Golden State will realize that the show that they're making is Golden State. There's a scene from Golden State that I've recreated as a TV.
That's hilarious. That's great. Just
for my own personal enjoyment, 100%. And the actor,
you gotta do that.
Well, yep. You got to do it, right? Just so that someone will send me an email a few months from now, and I'll be so happy that they
think
that, you know?
It's funny, speaking to, you mentioned like you within a square mile of where you live, it's like I could see that. Even when I was living in Philadelphia, when I read LA novels, I was the dork who would look things up like, oh, where is that? Oh, that's real.
It's fun.
Have to do that, right? You kind of have to. I mean, I'm a guy who like when I travel somewhere, I'll bring a novel set there because I want to learn the lay of the land from its novelists, not from a tour guide. I don't care about that. I care about who's lived there, so I think anyone lives near a square mile of West LA, they would be well served to have this as their tour guide.
I hope so.
I do want to ask you about now. Well, Bob Dylan, but well, that was yesterday. We can't do that anymore. But
no, I know. I know. There's a lot of Bob Dylan in this book.
There is, and I love it. I mean, I'm embarrassed to admit, I came to Bob Dylan late in my adult life. I was one of those guys who like, oh, he's whatever. But I now I realize he's genius. He's God.
Welcome.
I know. No, but huge aside from Bob Dylan, I do want to ask about your process. Like, you know, what is your? This always fascinates me. Kind of, you know. From start to finish, Quiet Boy, how did that evolve? And what was like thinking time versus writing time? I know you mentioned you had a gap where you stopped to write Golden State. Just what's your, if you have a typical, method, what is that?
I wish I did have a typical method. It would make life a lot easier. I feel like every book, it's different.
Yeah.
I feel like the book kind of teaches you how it wants you to write it in this weird way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This book I did, I wrote a lot and then I got frustrated with it. I had a different idea early on of what the affliction was that was going to be at the center of the book.
And
it wasn't working. There was a time where the boy was alive, but he just had a sort of whole mental thing going on. And I was like, I don't like this. I was very wary of it feeling like I never wanted to suggest by having him alive and awake and talking. I don't like things that are like, oh, he's schizophrenic, but he's actually possessed. Like I feel like there's a cultural thing that happens sometimes particularly with depictions of mental illness, where it's like, it's some sort of otherworldly thing that is going on that I didn't want to do that. It just felt, it feels reductive to me. And it feels sort of like, I don't know, lame. It feels like a little bit like it goes back to like the witches. Like, I don't know. Anyway, so
I hear you. That makes sense. Yeah.
It wasn't clicking. And then there was this whole thing where basically I felt frustrated with the book. And then when Trump was elected, I felt very moved to write Golden State, which is about sort of truth and lies and fascism and all that fun stuff. So when I came back to this book, it was with a stronger sense of what I wanted it to be. And so it started to move very quickly. There were numerous drafts. It's a long book. And because it has the two time frames, it's a pretty complicated book. And I work really closely with Josh Kendall, who's my editor, and Mulholland on this book.
Yeah.
He had a lot of very specific, very strong thoughts about what was going on with Wesley and how to handle it, the kind of antagonist character who there's this whole cult thing that happens where these weirdos are kind of obsessed with the boy.
Right.
They're trying to kidnap him. And then we find out why. And so I had a character in that place that was cheap and sort of cheesy and not working. And Josh sort of was like, he did the thing where he's like, well, this could work this way, but you're like, but it was good. It really helped a lot. And they also had some really great thoughts about Beth, the mom, and how to handle her grief, because grief can feel so static. It can feel so hokey. And he was like, he was just sort of basically like, why isn't she more just pissed off? Like, she feels so like,
yeah.
And then I was like, oh yeah, she's just really pissed off. And so the scene where I introduce her, where she's like essentially buttonholing this hospital administrator and wanting to like tear him. And like, I feel like any of us who've spent any time at a hospital, especially when we are processing what's going on with someone we love, it's just so infuriating. And
yeah, so true to life. So true. And that's what Beth's character really did impress me about. This is actually grief, how it actually happens. It really, you know, I asked about, you know, research, but you somehow intuited or you researched this, how it feels. It's real. It really feels real. And
there's that.
It isn't one note.
There's that telling detail about, you know, when you're going through some horrific loss, and you see a couple of guys just getting on shift, laughing and joking, and their world is completely different than yours is at that moment.
I know exactly the moment you're talking about. They're outside when Jay first meets Beth, and he's doing his Jay thing. He's trying to get her business. He's trying to get her to sign up. Yeah. And she's processing. She has no idea what's going on with her kid. And she's horrified and she's so angry. And there's a couple of ambulance workers who are just shooting the shit and smoking cigarettes. And it's like nuance. It's like life is so nuanced and it's so complicated. And like, we are all, each of us just on this journey that at which we are the center, but everyone else is on their own thing. And I actually remember a similar thing from when, I think it was my first child was born, and we are at, you know, my wife is in labor, and it's just like, for us, for her especially, it's like, Jesus Christ, there's nothing like this. There's never been a day like this. And it's so scary. And for her, obviously it's physically painful and crazy. And then I remember being like, the doctor was just like so rote And I was like, come on, I understand. It's just Thursday for you, but we have to work it up a little bit. This is the biggest day of our lives. You know, it's like, but it's just work. And I find that to be really interesting. And it's something that you see also in courts. And I get into that. And when they get to the criminal courthouse too, it's like, you know, for these people, this is, someone might be going, their son or daughter or whoever might be going to jail for 25 years. You know, someone might be, they're at the parole hearing. It could be life or death. And like, but then for the bailiff, you know, it's Thursday. And like that kind of, I find that really interesting.
I remember once, you know, my wife was going through some traumatic illness of some sort. She was in the hospital and everybody just seems so fucking casual, you know, like, and it's like all the, for once, you know, you're starting to age a little bit when everybody in the hospital seems like they're like 12, you know?
Oh,
they're all like,
you
know, like zoned out on their phones.
Yeah. Come on, dude. You're like, I know you, it's the, I'm the fourth person of the day, but like, it's my pancreas we're talking about or whatever it is.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, to me, it struck me as you have a lot of obviously empathy as a writer. You just inhabit these people in realistic ways. There is no cheap moments, you know, and all three of us as writers know those cheap moments, right? Oh, that's a rote response. Like, but you know, as Patrick mentioned, like that moment is wonderful. It's like, you feel like there's a pane of glass that separates you from the rest of the world when you're like involved in a happy moment, a horrifying moment, whatever it is. It feels like, okay, I'm going to remove. And you make that, even the quiet boy himself is fighting a secret war that we have no idea, you know, and that's wonderful. All your characters are doing that.
And they're both quiet boys too. That was another thing I wanted to bring up. Which one is the quiet boy?
Yeah.
You know?
Thank you. I think that was Josh who first said that to me, that Ruben might be the quiet boy.
Like, he's a quiet boy.
He is. And
was your title the same throughout? Did you have that title?
Multiple titles. In fact, so this book started, when this book started, it was called The Prisoner, which again, it's the stupid Easter egg thing, but in Golden State, because I was working on this book, in Golden State, which is a book about a world with no lies. It's illegal to lie. And so fiction is illegal. And at some point in Golden State, someone discovers, it's like Samizdat, someone has a secret as a novel in their house, and it's a big thing. And that novel is called The Prisoner. And it's basically this book. It was called The Prisoner. And then Mulholland, the publisher, they didn't like The Prisoner because of the famous television series. And I pushed back on that for a little bit. And then I kept changing the title. I changed it like 100 times. For a while, it was actually called Nobody Feels Any Pain, which is a Dylan quote that comes up in the book. But that covers up. And the quiet boy, I can't remember. It might have been Josh who suggested. It might have been me. We're like, oh, yeah, that's it. That's the title. So I do love it. I love the cover. I think they do a great job of the covers.
So have you noticed everything? Sorry, Patrick.
I was just gonna say, since before we let Dylan go away, let's just nerd out on Bob Dylan for a minute or two.
Yes.
What are your favorite eras of Dylan?
Oh, Patrick, you don't want to. I mean, so I have several favorite eras. So actually, surprisingly, I'm a huge fan of the Christian period.
What?
I know. It's weird because I'm Jewish, first of all. But like, I love some of those songs so much. And actually, the original title of The Last Policeman, speaking of titles, was Slow Train Coming, which is the title of the first of those albums. And
beautiful.
And it's about Judgment Day, right? It's about the Messiah coming, but it's also just about, for me, it's about the fact that we're all going to die one day. And what I find so remarkable about those albums, despite the fact that his songwriting is not at peak, and he's also obviously singing about something that I do not connect to personally, I just love someone doing something with so much passion. There's so much passion on those records. Like, he cares so fucking much about what he's singing. Like, I find it really moving. So I love that era. I love the 90s stuff. I love Time Out of Mind. I love Love.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Albums are. And actually, this one that just came out last year.
Yeah.
Anyways, like, I remember. I
haven't heard it.
Oh, my God. It was so early pandemic. It was like right at the end of March. And it was like, oh, Bob Dylan just dropped a single. And it's a 13-minute murder ballad about
JFK.
JFK assassination. It's like, oh, yeah, I forgot. Dylan lives on another planet. But and yet somehow, it felt so moving to me. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
What's your favorite era, Patrick? Do you have a favorite?
You know what's funny? I really like Oh Mercy is one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. That kind of spooky Daniel Lanois production.
Sure. And,
there's crickets on that album. There's literal crickets in the sound design of that album.
It's funny. I was just listening to an interview with Lanois, and he was talking about how they saw that as a nighttime record. And they only recorded at night.
Yeah.
Wow. In New Orleans, you know, and that makes sense. But I like the more recent stuff. It's funny. I love, you know, Blood on the Tracks and some of that stuff. How can you not? But musically, I mean, I love his lyrics. And I like that as he's aged and gotten more reflective, the lyrics have gotten, I don't know, I'm just connecting with them more.
Totally.
And, but the musically, I saw him a couple of years ago live here in Phoenix, which is the only time I've ever seen him. And the band was so unbelievably good.
His band is incredible.
And he just kind of staggered around and staggered around and picked up the harmonica and played it.
He doesn't talk either. He basically stopped talking at a certain point. He's like, I'm not going to banter anymore. It's just all the songs. He'll say thank you maybe once. It's incredible.
I like how he deconstructs and reinterprets his own like big hits.
Yep.
I respect that, you know, because it's like people hate him for it.
No, but he's not going to be a museum piece. I think he decided just not. This actually goes to your question earlier on, Duane, about like what kind of writer, you know, it's like, I like that every album, he's just like, it's going to be its own thing. It's like, you know, Elton John or God bless him, but like he's been making the same album. Like, you know, he had a couple, like.
Sure, yeah.
And there's this famous guy, because, you know, Billy Joel quit recording. He was like, at a certain point, he's like, I can't write the same kind. I'm not as good a songwriter anymore, so I'm going to stop. And Billy Elton John was like, why would you stop making albums? And Billy Joel was like, why would you keep making albums? Like, you know, like, you have plenty of money. You know that quality isn't the same. But like Dylan, I think, was like, I want each thing to be its own thing. I want it to be interesting for me. And I think that his listeners, the people who love him, are like, I'm just going to go where he goes. And I'm going to trust that even if it's nothing like the last thing, I'm going to like it because I trust his intelligence and I trust his spirit. And it's like the same, like Elvis Costello, who I also just super love. Yeah. The same thing is like, he's just on a journey. And like
Tom Waits,
exactly. Like Blood Money is so different than like, you know, the 70s stuff, but like, I love it all. And same so here, I want to be that kind of writer. Like, whether or not people come along with me, it's like, I'm just, each book is, it's kind of its own universe, but hopefully there's something that connects it. That's just like, well, it's a Ben book and, you know, like it or leave it. It's, you know.
Yeah. I mean, even like Dylan's outtakes. I remember 5 or 6 years ago, they released an outtake, a different version of Visions of Johanna. It was like, it felt like, oh my God, this feels so modern. It's so like psychotic and chaotic. It's like, this is written for now, not 1966, whatever, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's like, wow, what is this thing? He just like tucked it away, it felt like, until like we were ready to hear it. That to me impressed the shit out of me. You mentioned Revolver before. That was like his one song, It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, was like a huge, huge like psychological and spiritual influence in that book. It was like, it just sort of, this is what the book's about. This is like, I feel this book because this
song. Awesome. That's awesome.
That's like, great. I don't know if you guys, you know, build like playlists for your novels or for story. I do that all the time. I have to have a soundtrack that puts me like, it's shorthand for putting you in an emotional place of a certain
late 60s and 70s music in that novel. I remember. I would love to hear your playlist for that.
Oh, I mean, I just soaked in it because I felt like I have to time travel somehow, right? So I want to time travel. To me, the easiest way to do that is music. I'm back there, you know.
What was your Canary playlist?
That was more. It's funny, a mix of like the two main characters, like of a modernish sort of indie rock and like. What would a 30-year-old black cop listen to? Yeah, it's like that kind of, you know, idea of like, what are these two clashing, you know, but it's all the same fabric. Philly is a very, you know, musically rich city. So I just leaned into that, tapped into that, you know.
Have you read that one, Ben?
I have not actually.
Oh man, that's such a great
Canary book. More recent than Revolver, or is Canary older than Revolver?
It's a previous book, yeah. It came out, I guess, 2000, they came out back to back, but and it's sort of, Revolver is almost a sequel to Canary, kind of. There's some characters who carry over.
I didn't know that.
I sort of resist series. I kind of my first books were Mulholland were a series, but my idea was to burn down the series as it was happening out of perversity. So I'm not a good series writer.
I sort of did that with Last Policeman. I was like, oh, that's a great character. Exactly, I guess I'll just destroy the world.
Exactly. That was I'm so impressed by that, because you did the same impulse of like, yeah, let's just like write a series where you're not getting out of this one. This is not going to end well for you. This won't go on. You know?
With Underground Airlines, people were like, is there going to be a sequel? I was like, no. Like that, it's such a painful and difficult thing for reader to, you know, for me to write and for the character to experience. It's like, unless there's a really good reason for it, I'm not going to go back into that, you know, that terrible universe, you know?
No, I hear you. It's very strange. But you know, actually, well, what here, I should ask you, what's next for you? What's, can we peek inside your head and see what's going on with you?
I'm writing a book, as I tend to. I've actually had a project for Audible recently that are, I just finished writing a thing for Audible. I think I can talk about this.
You mentioned this to me during lunch. You didn't tell me what it was.
So it's called Self-Help, and it's about a guy who, a mysterious ad shows up on his phone for a Audible wouldn't let me call it Audible in my story. It's an audio book company. An ad pops up for a strange audiobook. So he downloads it, and it's an audiobook. It's like a self-help book. It's this guy's like a schlub, like his life is falling apart. He lives in LA and he's an actor. But the audiobook then starts talking to him directly and specifically and telling him what to do.
Wow.
And then eventually
Philip K. Dick kind of idea.
It is very Dick. And then he becomes a burglar basically. And then he commits a murder. So it's like a sort of like, it's really fun. It's really fun. So that should come out. I just finished writing it and he's really pleased with it. So that should come out hopefully over the summer. You know, and I love Audible because he'll just record it. Like the process is a little quicker.
Yeah. Do you cast it yourself? Do you direct these episodes? How does it work?
No. They have a pretty good, I actually recommended the guy, William Demerit, who is the audiobook reader for Quiet Boy. He's the same guy who did Underground Airlines. I think he's fantastic. So I'm
hoping
he's just a great, terrific actor. And he happens to be half African American and half Jewish. So he speaks to my, he was able to inhabit that world in a way that
that's great.
I couldn't, because I'm always want to read him. But and then also with Quiet Boy, he just has his ear is it's extraordinary. Anyhow, we're going to the next book from Mulholland. I'm writing a book called Big Time that is it's a corporate espionage novel. Not time travel exactly, but some time manipulation elements essentially.
Interesting. All right.
Yeah, so
I'm gonna call it maybe a tenet that makes sense.
Yeah, a little bit. I hope so. It's called Big Time, as in like big agriculture or big time. I'm a few months into that. It's really fun. I'm trying to write it a little quicker. This one took a couple of years, so I'm trying to just like, I say that every time.
Life just has a funny way of getting in the way, right? I mean, you have other things you're juggling as a writer. How do you do that? How do you juggle, TV writing with novel writing? You worked on, I know Legion you worked on and other things.
I'm on a show right now that's just wrapping up, a limited series for Apple that that's not my show, but I'm a.
Cool.
They call it a producer. I'm a stat, I'm in the writing room. Which I'm not allowed to say what it is, but it's super, super cool that hopefully they're going to announce it soon and I'll let you know. So that's been really very instructive because I've worked, I've just been really more involved in a way that Legion was really fun, but it was very much like Noah Hawley who ran that show. Like he just has a very specific vision. It's really his, it's been a super fun show. Apple thing. So I'm working on that. And then I think the rest of the summer is going to be pretty much just writing the book.
Novel.
Yeah. And then, driving the kids to camp, that sort of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, do you do your novel stuff at night? Like, certain Dylan albums? No, you do it whenever you can.
No cricket sound effects. I cannot work at night. I get so tired and I do not have a nighttime brain. I get very sleepy. Yeah. So my jam is to work as soon as I possibly can at the beginning of the day. So once I run with the dog most mornings and then I get the kids off to where, whatever my parenting responsibility is. And then I try to sit down as soon as possible and write as much as possible. I try to not, the secret is to not go on the internet as long as possible. So if I can not check my email until, 11, that's the dream. But it gets, it's hard,
it's so hard. Yeah.
My best secret there's a program I use called Freedom. That's just, it's an app you can install on your whatever. And it essentially, you can tell it how many minutes it just turns off the internet for that amount of time. So I've used that now for a few years. I say a few years, I've used it for literally 15 years, but like
actually a good segue because before we wrap up, I just wanted to talk a little bit about, when I was reading your book, I was aware of, 2008, right? It's not that long ago, but if you think about it in the general, whatever the general scheme of things is, which I hate people that use that expression, the general scheme of things, because is there one? But anyway, the massive difference that's kind of snuck up on us all between 2008 and 2019,
Yeah.
Think about that difference between, you know, 1821 to whatever that is, you know, 1840.
Yeah.
And then look at the same chunk of time.
It's crazy. I mean, I think in terms of the rapid advance of technology, particularly online culture, and what it has done to both to the sort of fabric of society and the way we interact with one another, but also to our individual consciousness and the way that we interact with information is staggering. And I think you're right in terms of like, well, what was it? What happened between 1630 and 1640? Well, people pretty much just kept digging holes or whatever. You know what I mean? Like,
life of trouble.
Yeah. I think it's scary in a way. And it's also, it's interesting to just note it because we don't really note it. We don't really think about it much.
Yeah.
But like the fact that so much of our day is consumed with taking our phones in and out of our pockets and checking up on, well, I posted something 45 minutes ago. I should probably see if anyone commented on it so I can put a little heart by their comments. Like, this is all, what?
So weird, right? Weird. So
weird. And in a way it's pernicious. And I think particularly for those of us who make our living on our wits, or, you know, it's like, it isn't even our wits. It's our attention. It's our attention span, right? So to be able to write a novel,
you have
to
think
and cohesively over a long period of time. And like the world has conspired to make that more and more difficult. And like, I wonder if longitudinally, if people will be like, well, fiction has really suffered. It feels like people are still reading a lot. So that's good. But it's really remarkable how much the world.
I know that you said that, you know, a lot of this book reflects your own, you know, as a parent, your own experience as a parent. And, you know, my wife's a teacher. And are you making observations about, you know, I don't know, about kids and attention span and things like this?
I think I have to be. It's funny because the kids in the book are in the 2008 timeframe. It's interesting. I don't think I did this on purpose, but like my kids are my oldest kid is 14. So she's the age that Ruben is in the book. But she's that age now in 2020. Yeah. So the kids in the book don't have the super internet. They don't have phones. Like my kids now are 14 and 12 have phones.
Sure.
Which I feel like I mean, we obviously didn't have phones. I've got my first cell phone as an adult.
Yeah.
It certainly wasn't a smartphone either. So I think I didn't have to sort of engage with that exactly, but I have observed my kids a little bit, and the way that Ruben and Evie interact as kids is informed by them, I'm sure. And I think the way that Wes's friends in his band, or the other kids in the novel are Wes's high school friends, like that's me. It's almost more than almost anything else I've ever written. That's pretty much one-to-one with me and my friends. When he finds them at the food court and they're just eating just like disgusting crap and like teasing each other, but in a kind of nice way, you know, like that's just me and my friend.
Totally.
Playing music and like changing band name every 20 minutes.
Thought a little bit of that movie. Did you guys see that movie Pi? Mathematical symbol Pi.
Well, the Darren Aronofsky.
Yeah.
I didn't. He lost me with whatever the first one was.
For some reason it kind of flickered through my mind. I was just wondering if it was in the background of your consciousness somewhere.
Not that one.
No.
I was going to say, in terms of my friends, I think this book has more of me in it. You know, some books are more personal without you meaning to. There's a lot more in this book that is reflective of my experience than I think anything else I've written. Like,
in terms of
Jewish, in terms of, like I'm a bass player. One of the characters plays bass, like, and the music and all the lawyers. I don't know.
You're a bass player?
Well, yeah, I don't play anymore, but I grew up playing bass in a band. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Cool. I grew up playing keyboards in my father's bar and wedding band. So, sort of bass, keys. Patrick, do you play anything?
I play guitar. Yeah. Let's start
a band.
We've seen a drummer. There's got to be a crime writer drummer out there.
Let's get your old man on drums.
Yeah. I love that. God.
That's cool.
There's so much in this book that I think.
Yeah.
It's like I couldn't have written this book 5 years ago. And I think that it's like everything, I think being a parent influenced this book more than I realized as I was writing it.
You know, if I can say, you know, last year you described at lunch this book to me, and I want to say you were wrong because you said, it's weird. I'm not sure it all works. It's all bizarre. I'm not sure you'll like it. And I'm like, you know, goddamn you, Ben, it works beautifully. It's wonderful. It all hangs together. And in fact, not to, of course, never spoil things, but you know, my big problem with a lot of novels is they don't know how to stick the landing. They don't know how to stick the ending. And this, God damn you, it does. It's just beautiful. Yeah, so
it's amazing.
I think, you know, really, I mean, it's rare that someone has a great idea that starts and it kind of, you know, how to keep the, you know, the plot motions going. But it feels like often a lot of books I finish like, that was it. That's where it goes. It feels like cheap. You just, bam.
Thank you.
I won't say what it is, of course, but man.
Labored over the last scene a lot. And
I still want to have lunch with you and talk about the ending because it's like, God, that's so.
And there, we can do it now, man. Masks off.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, but we'll go back to origami. Yeah.
I think it's funny. It's just like, if you get down to it, it's like, yeah, I just like being in Ben Winter's mind for a little while.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Fuck.
I wish I could not be in Ben Winter's mind.
Yeah, or Dwayne's mind. Dwayne's twisted mind.
I do.
Yeah, the mind that produces severance package and expiration date.
You want no part of my brain, trust me. You want no part of it.
You got to get you writing novels again. Come on, man.
Yeah.
I'm working on one now, and it's actually I can't announce this officially, but I may be back with a certain publishing house that Ben knows very well, and we all know and love. And
Is there a drive in Los Angeles that is associated with that name?
With what name?
Mulholland.
There is. I was around for that naming because it was I was one of the first authors to sign up in Mulholland back when John Schoenfelder was, you know, running the imprint. Yeah. And I went to a few at least one time we were having drinks just trying to find out what should we call this imprint. And I have like all kinds of awful names. And at one point we were talking about, you know, he loved, you know, fascinating movies and Hollywood, and Mulholland kind of came up. That was his idea. I can't take credit for it, but it was definitely him.
Great name.
And it was, it sticks. And when I was promoting my first books from Mulholland, I did a very dumb thing where I drove Mulholland Drive. Someone nailed me a camera from Mulholland, a little brown, and I drove while holding a camera drive. It's like, that was stupid. I could have died. You know, I should have done that, but it was for promotional purposes for a book. So sure, right?
I was just driving it 2 days ago to go for a hike. We drive up there all the time. And I think very fun.
Oh, that's cool.
Oh yeah, we're up there all the time.
It's beautiful, yeah.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much. It's been a really fun hour. And for everybody watching, we will have our signed hardcovers of the wonderful book, The Quiet Boy, very shortly.
Please buy this. And I'm glad you guys are doing so well. You're doing so many events, and I hope we're selling a lot of books too.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
And you know, we're slowly moving into more open, you know, in-person events and things like that.
Well, you can sign me up when I finish big time. I'll be there. I'll be there in person.
Great.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So when we sign off, give us one thing that you've read recently or you're reading now that you'd like, that you really, really have liked.
Does it have to be a crime novel?
No.
I'll give you one. I just finished A Man Named Dahl, the Jonathan Ames.
Yes.
Crime novel.
Great.
So he wrote You Were Never Here, which is also fucking fantastic. He's had an incredible career. But anyway, so A Man Named Dahl is great. Highly recommended. Hysterical and also scary and weird. But then I read the biography of Mike Nichols that came out this year.
Oh, yeah.
Which like I was just, and I'm not a super like Hollywood. I mean, I love theater and I love movies. And I was like, oh, this sounds really interesting. It was so great and so interesting. And there's so much about the creative process and like what it is to have a life in the arts and the ups and downs of it and the emotional burden it can be, but also the joy that like, I'm totally gonna recommend this to everybody who's like a writer or an actor or whatever. It's like, it's
great. I gotta read that.
Yeah, it's really great. I read it in like a week. I tore through it.
Wow.
That's awesome.
What about you, Dwayne?
I just finished a book by Mick LaSalle, who's a San Francisco film critic, called Dream State, about movies in California. You know, kind of the, but it's not at all, you know, it's not a dry rundown of every movie shot in California. It kind of captures for me like the appeal and the horror of this state. It was like why we're drawn to it, but also, and why we like, it's really smart kind of nonfiction, a bunch of essays about, you know, what's set here and why. It just came out, I want to say a month ago or a few weeks ago.
What's the author's name again?
Mick LaSalle, called Dream State. If you pardon my shorts here. Oh, here we go.
Have you read The Mirage Factory by Gary?
This is the book. I thought it was great. I mean, I just, again, even the opening chapter kind of nailed, it's like people come here on vacation and think, oh, wow, it's sunny, it's warm, it's wonderful, I want to live here. But it's like, yeah, there's a flip side. You know, it's almost like this sort of, here's the illusion. This is the dream factory. don't know, it was a very smart take on an obsession of mine, which is you grow up, like, I didn't grow up here. Ben, you didn't grow up here. It's this idea of like, we see these places in our, or these movies, these, you know, movies we watched as a kid, realize, oh, this is where the dreams happen. You get here and it's just a, you realize there's, it's a very, God, a multi-layered dream, you know, it's not all.
I'm gonna read that. I'm gonna read yeah. it. Hey, Dad, have you read The Mirage Factory?
By yes. The one about how religion, water, yep. and film.
Yep. About Mulholland.
Yes.
And
yes.
Amy Temple McPherson and the guy who did, directed yeah. Earth of a Nation. And it's just yes. about the movies. It's just about how Los Angeles came to be through all these
exactly.
crazy
beautiful
people and crazy machinations. Really interesting book.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
I haven't read it yet. I need to pick that up.
Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah. I guess I'll throw into the mix a couple of them.
Yeah.
Our friend Richard Lang has that new book out called Rovers.
Rovers.
Yep. Wow, what a book.
It's really good. I have the galley up here. Yep.
It's great. Same here. It's my behind me on my shelf. Can't wait to read it.
It's yep. wonderful. And also there's a book coming. Do you guys know this British, really brilliant British writer named David Peace?
Oh yeah.
I do not.
Yeah.
1974, 1970. Exactly. Yeah, in the
Ben, you got to check this guy out too. He has these series of books that he's written that are about a detective in occupied Tokyo right after World War II.
Ooh.
And the first one's called Tokyo Year Zero.
So good.
Look at that book.
It is a tour de force.
Oh my God. There's
and he's done another one called Occupy. I mean, they've sold like 5 copies in the States, but
I will get crap for this, but David Peace is a coherent James Ellroy. I love Ellroy. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying, like,
I love feel like Ellroy. Too.
Struck by crime novelist lightning. Yeah. That was quite heretical. I liked it.
I know. I'm sorry. I love Ellroy. I worship Ellroy, but it's like it's just David Peace has that kind of Telegraph style that like it's tabloidy. It's
unbelievable.
The style. It's just Scorpion style. Yeah.
I'm gonna order it. I'm gonna order it tonight.
He has a new one called Tokyo Redux, which is coming out in not for the summer and. I'm going to be reviewing it for somebody I can't say who, but I oh man,
is that like the third part of his trilogy or is that a separate
third
part of the third
part. Okay, yeah,
but I gotta start at the beginning, right? All right, I'll start. All right, guys, I think my dog just decided we're done.
No problem. Thanks again, everybody.
Awesome. Thanks Patrick, thanks so much
Dwayne. Nice to see you both.
Hello, we hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.